Yeah. Okay, so I guess, shall we just get going? Yeah, so basically I guess I thought that it would be a good opportunity for us to discuss some of the issues which have come up in the last couple of years, thinking about the internal cycles of active particles. So so I guess typically, if you, you know, if you think about your a pragmatic active particle, I mean, I don't know, you've got your Kalamata-Morris or something, which is swimming. It's actually not a static object. It's really doing something like this, you know. And then it's doing, then it's, you know, and then we'll, I don't know, and then we have a cycle. So we've got this object which is...
In addition to moving around.
Of course, and of course we know that...
In addition, it's because of that that it moves.
Uh-huh.
Okay, exactly.
Right.
So it's moving in that direction, and it has this internal cycle. And typically what has been done is to say, well, actually we can just think of this object as having some anisotropic degree of freedom, and let's look at the consequences of that. But of course, there is this cycle. So one of the things that we started thinking about was, can we try to study in a little bit more detail what happens when you have such a cycle? So so essentially speaking, that means that if I think of my active particle, and I'm now going to think of having n particles, so I have n active particles. And I have, in addition to that thing, some cycle. So it's going through some cycle, I don't know. And if it's going through a periodic cycle, then if I look at different individuals, they will not necessarily be at the same point in their cycle. One way of dealing with that is to think about a phase. Okay, so our set of particles is going to have, we can think of, we have some position of mixed particle, some thing which is measuring the fact that it's oriented in some sense, it's moving. And I've got my phase variable, which is measuring the relative differences in, or with some reference of where each particle cycle is.
Can I ask you, sorry,
yeah.
Simple. So you're assuming that motion is always fully periodic, right?
Exactly.
Always absolutely repeated on every side.
Yeah. So, I mean, the simple
answer. The individual
part. The simple answer, we'll do that, I'll relax it eventually. But we're starting off initially with, think about a deterministic process, which is purely periodic. Then I'm going to add some noise to that.
Okay.
But for now, let's think of these objects as being purely periodic objects.
Then R and U will be dependent on P. They will not be independent variables.
Exactly. So now these will all dynamically be varying. That's the whole point. That my system, I have a dynamical system where this will vary because this is going to be moving, governed by u, because it swims in direction u. So my r will be changing with respect to u, and similarly my u, you know, will depend on. In general, as kind of we'll see, it will depend on the orientation will depend on where the other particles are and things like that. So. Assuming the phase will depend on where other particles are and what phases they have. Okay, so essentially what's new here is really that we have this phase degree of freedom. And
so Danny, I had a question, not about this actually.
Yeah.
You know, because I don't know history of what's been going on in the past two plus or three modules. The general hydrodynamics of just a collection of things with an R and a U has been talked about to death, I assume.
I presume so. I don't need to.
Not that we want to go over it. I mean, just the difference.
Might be useful to write it down.
No, at least we can just say a word.
Because, when you do the file, you'll probably write it down.
Yeah. Right? Yes. So effectively speaking, I want to say something about static things and talk about force dipoles and things like that. So I think.
But if I just consider a single particle, both R and U are. Sleep to phi, right? I mean, just for a single particle.
For a single particle, that would be the case. So, I mean, I would, assuming again that it's a purely periodic thing where there's no noise, then R and U would be governed by phi.
And then if it's inner fluid, in addition, what the fluid does to R and U is important.
Mm-hmm.
R and U relative to the fluid, that means, you know, the co-moving, co-rotating derivative of the particle, the field discovering the particle in any state.
Okay.
Sorry, I shouldn't interrupt.
No, no. I mean, that's the whole point of the discussion, isn't it? Exactly. So, so the next step then is to so obviously being the kind of people we are, then we start thinking about describing these systems and looking for structure. Okay, and so one type of structure is whether or not you can break the symmetry. So of course, you could imagine that we have a bunch of these objects. So we have some isotropic phase, and then I could I go to some oriented phase. Okay, so I've broken rotational symmetry, and typically one would capture that by some kind of order parameter. So. So I could think about, I'm going to call it P for polarization, but I could, and I would sum over all my particles. So each particle, and so this is just a measure of, and essentially here, and this is clearly a vector, so I could, it's going to be, and if this is non-zero, then I would have some order. If it's zero, then I'm in some isotropic phase. Okay. Now, clearly, I with my phase variable. Again, I could think of now having a bunch of particles. Let's represent them as being somewhere in this circle on my cycle. So this would be my isotropic phase, if you want. I've got all my particles over the thing, and then, you know, I go and roughly speaking, you know, they're all oriented in this space.
So is that an assumption to say that the emergence of polarization is associated with synchronization?
Well, at the moment, I'm just saying that these are the possible things that could happen.
Okay.
And then I've got no dynamics now. Yeah.
No, to answer the question, which is that it's assumed that it is perfectly possible to have an oriented phase which is not synchronized.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
You can have, I mean, the point is there's various.
So there are two possible things, right?
Yeah.
Two possible broken symmetries.
And in principle, translational also.
Yes, and translational. And so you could have
this. So this is breaking time.
This is breaking. So now, we've broken rotational symmetry. Let me just write the symmetry. So we have rotational. Mm-hmm. And this is sort of time translation.
Time translation, yeah.
Okay. It's a sort of interesting, it's an interesting, slightly non-trivial way of bringing time transition symmetry. Because if you think about it, when you have an anisotropic object, you've locally broken rotational symmetry at the object. But of course, what you're talking about really is a global breaking of rotational symmetry. So clearly, once you have a cycle, you've locally broken time transition symmetry. But of course, what you're talking about is a global breaking of time transition symmetry when all the particles are all in phase.
Technical thing that I didn't quite follow. So when you define the order parameter there,
yeah.
Even if the whole collection is isotropic, the summation of the delta would not cancel.
Okay, so actually I've been sloppy here. These are most functions of R. And then typically what you do is average over the I'm gonna average over my whole my volume, and then I'm gonna ask about the average over the volume.
No, okay. I didn't understand. What was your question?
Well, if you just have a discrete collection of particles and you sum them up as
okay.
There.
Well, yeah, so there is an averaging. The RIs are running around. So
that's right. There's a lot of averaging. You're saying that there's many particles in
So basically, this thing here is I'm taking a little volume of my space, and I'm just taking a little volume box, and I'm saying, and I'm summing over all the particles. I was kind of slow. So this n here is over the number of particles inside this little box.
Right.
So I've got a box here, and then.
So you don't actually need delta function.
No, I mean, exactly, of course. I'm in a maths department, so I wouldn't even, if I was in my home institution, I wouldn't dare do something like that.
Yeah.
Because I would get absolutely, you know, attacked.
Yeah. Applied maths departments.
Oh, yes, yeah. Yeah, so, no, I mean, of course.
Dirac is from Bristol.
Yes, I know, and he was, Dirac was the first year of applied math in Bristol. He was the first, he was the student, there were three of them in that year. And that, so that was the first year they had an applied math program in Bristol, and he was the three. And of course he came top.
Of course.
But there was only two other people in the class who apparently we haven't heard of since. You know, so, okay, there's a sense in which we understand that this is a test function, that there is some, we're taking some limits, you know, and, you know, and, okay. So we can similarly in the same way, I can think about defining an order parameter for the phase, okay? So I'm, again, I take my little box, and now I'm going to do, okay? And so it's a complex, number. And the reasons for doing it are that it's actually nice because you can then relate the real part, the amplitude of it to something like this magnitude here, and the phase is the slow variable in this.
So if I wanted to look at things like anti-phase synchronization, I can generalize that by putting these cubes.
Yes, exactly. Okay. And so this I could now define as some magnitude, and I'm going to use some. And similarly, in the same way, when this is non-zero, then I have phase coherence, synchronization, whatever you like to call it, and this thing is a, this is your slow mode. Okay, and let me just say something now briefly about static. So let's ignore the phase variable for now. So let's say what I call vanilla active matter is that we have basically some.
You are not considering spatial order.
I am considering spatial order.
So, do you have an order parameter you
want to
talk about?
You mean translation invariance? You mean, no, I'm not going to consider translation invariance.
You can, but
I'm not going to do that here.
I understand.
Yes. Okay. Okay, so let's think about this case where I don't have any thermodynamics, I just have these arrows. So we're thinking of self propelled particles, and we.
Just one little remark?
Yeah.
Something that maybe is obvious to everybody but wasn't obvious to me when I started working on this.
Yeah.
Is that the difference between this kind of ordering of phases and an ordinary XY model, say, ordering of phases, is that in the XY model, at the level of a single particle, all possible orientations of that XY vector are equivalent.
Yeah.
And it's only the lining up of the vectors across all these guys that's the ordering.
Yeah.
If you want to have phase coherence in a dynamical sense, you actually have to have markings on the phase orbit of each particle so that each individual clock hand knows where it is on its orbit. Whereas if you had a bunch of rotors, suppose you had one rotor here in which all directions are equivalent, another rotor here in which all directions are equivalent, it's meaningless to talk about the phase coherence of those guys because there's no sense in which you can mark any one point of the orbit as being distinct from another. So if you look at all the models in which you get dynamical phase coherence,
yes.
You actually got a modulated order parameter space.
Exactly. So you
I always think of this as an XY.
It's actually different. This is why, since I spent a little while thinking it as an XY, I thought maybe it's worth.
Yes, that's
I mean,
okay.
Right. So you got a rotor here. For this rotor to cohere with another rotor, you actually have to have some marking on the, you know, each rotor is.
Well, you're saying there is like a time.
Or an external field, which coupled.
Anything, a field is, sure.
That's what you usually do.
In these systems, you, it's not obvious what
the field would be, because these are dynamic systems. So it's not obvious how you would,
how you couple
this phase.
You know? These are not pointing necessarily in space. These are internal, you know, this is a swimming
stroke. So
I don't understand.
It's physically
being. Yeah. It's physically non-trivial to do that.
No, it's a field in an abstract space. Yeah, it's not a field in space.
I
understand that. Yeah. I'm saying that it could have a physical meaning. Mm. You know, if you couple to those flagella or something.
No, it does have a physical meaning, and it is exactly a field in that sense. It's a field in internal space. So, you know, if you want one thing's space to lock to another thing's space, there has to be some marking, which is a field, on the phase orbit. Otherwise, there's no, you know, it's because you've got, if you have complete rotation invariance on each of the tracks.
Oh,
the
I see what you're saying.
How does, you know.
Okay.
I need to mark some point on the thing and say this. I'm going to compare this point on the cycle for each one. Yes.
So I just thought, as I said, since I spent a long time being confused about Sepot.
Okay.
So does that influence the kind of ordering that you get?
I haven't seen.
When you write down the model, you will find that you need.
Yes. Yes.
I mean, all swimmers have it anyway.
Yes. I mean, and again, it just you have a, and actually, any most of the models.
What you're saying is, I can take one oscillator at this point in space and compare it to an oscillator.
Yeah, because
this is.
I have to have one point. Yes. And that's just sort of a little bit careful and precise and thinking about what you mean by a phase. So the way we have done it in our things is we have a cycle and we choose a point on the cycle and we just compare those that point in the cycle. That's what
it is. There is a distinguished point in the cycle.
And that's it.
Yeah.
So actually it's like a clock model with infinitely thin markings and
something. It can be finite, it doesn't matter whether you need a model. You just need to say,
the peak of my sign, or...
Yes, exactly. So you need to choose...
Is that because it's coupled to the motion of the thing?
No, just as a phase.
Supposing you had a bunch of degrees of freedom, each of which lived on a circle.
Yeah.
At each site, you have a degree of freedom living on a circle, and there was nothing to tell you where on the circle you are. Then there is no meaningful way to talk about this motion on this circle as being in phase with this one, because there is no...
But this is always a relative phase, right?
No, relative is only if you can place them up against each other. If you can place them up against each other, then you know that they're relative.
Sorry.
You just need a marking. I mean, maybe it's a trivial point, since I was stupid enough to get confused for it once.
In two different coordinates. Okay, sorry.
Something like fixing a gate, if you want.
You need to solve an issue.
Can I think of it as a swimmer, for example, this is a swimmer which have different phases of depending on its configuration of the reactors are.
I want to look at this configuration in each one.
These are different markings.
Yes.
You will always have it in physical realism. It's as if this is, you know, this is my therapy, and I was confused about this one.
This is what happens when you try to always use symmetries and don't have Microsoft models.
Yeah. But it's so much easier.
Okay, so basically, again, I want to just emphasize here. So for our normal, going back to our picture of our static active particles. So this would be our, this measures the order. This tells us whether or not we have orientational order. And this is our slow mode. And so typically we've got this, the sort of paradigmatic model that people have is that I've got a particle which is moving by itself, so there's no external, it's not moving because of external fields or anything like that. So there's Newton's law tells me that there's no external forces. This is not, this is not quite true for all swimmers because you often have gravity, so there is sedimentation. But let's think about a neutrally buoyant active particle, which is basically the same density as the fluid it's moving in. And it moves, and it, of course, if it's moving, then there's no external force on it. So how is that possible? Well, it must mean that if I do the integral of the stress tensor over the center of the object, it's zero. And the simplest thing which I can think of which will do that is a force dipole. So if you want, so I'm going to call, if you want, the vanilla active particles, static active particles. the force multiple, and we're going to take a dipole. And there's going to be two types of dipole that we could think of easily. I mean, I could put them at some angle, but essentially they're dipoles where the forces are pointing outwards and the forces are pointing inwards. Okay? So this is a... Now, who coined this, Shriyam? You must know.
No, this was in the trade already. The fluid dynamics guys are...
So this was the fluid people. So this is basically Pedley and Co.
Pedley and all those guys. This is an old...
Yeah. So this is basically... So this is due to...
This is not us. Movers and shakers is due to us.
Yes. Okay. So...
But that's different.
So basically you have this pusher and puller. So that's those are the sort of two classes where the forces are pointing outwards or inwards. And of course, there's been a lot of work done on studying these systems and using various methods. And more or less, what I want to highlight is one of the things that I think is interesting to try to understand this phase behavior is to look at what happens when you have an oriented phase. So if you have, imagine now you have an oriented phase, so we now have a phase where this P is non-zero, and we will look at the variation of N, okay? And let's think about the pushers or the pullers. So if we have the pushers, so we have a bunch of particles which do this. We just have to look at, if we think about these forces and the sort of flows they generate, you can sort of now imagine that I make a little bend in this, in my oriented phase, then because of the fact that I'm generating flows in here, this bend is unstable. It'll actually tend to grow because I've got this mismatch here, and so I'm going to have more flow, and that's going to make things bigger. So I've got this tendency for these pushers to bend. So if you want,
I'm sorry, I'm not familiar with this. So could you just orient me a little? You know, all this would apply to a flock of birds. Are they pushers or pullers?
So, sorry?
A flock of birds can be oriented, right? It flies on a cycle and so forth. Right? Mm-hmm. Pushers or pullers?
Okay, good. So now that's, okay, now you're asking questions about, you're asking questions, first thing is that comparing a flock of birds to one of these,
yeah.
difference, of course, one difference is Reynolds number. So, I mean, so these objects are small, have low Reynolds number, the flock of birds, I have to worry about inertia and things like that.
You could
make a model with inertia, and I think a lot of this phenomenology still will still follow through. However, the additional thing birds have is they have a brain.
But I think we should answer his question.
Okay.
Right? I mean, what's the force density associated with one flying, flapping bird? Mm-hmm. First of all, birds aren't neutrally buoyant, so there is a force monopole, mm-hmm. which it combats by generating lift,
yes.
but it also generates thrust.
Yeah.
If you look hard at how a bird flies, probably its head is, you know, the part of its body that pushes the fluid forward is probably ahead of its wings, but I don't know. You know, the thing is, the trouble with the pusher-puller thing is not really a conserved charge. You can do local manipulations and change a pusher to a puller.
Uh-huh.
Okay, so, I mean, that's a bit worrisome to me, but I think it's true.
That's in some sense what I'm worried about.
It is. So I think it's contingent on exactly where you put the force dipole. Mm-hmm. You can clearly move those two around locally without
changing it. By moving it around exactly.
Yes. Uh-huh. And you can even think about actually having it with the axis. So you could do something like this, for example.
But you could do the flow around the bird.
You can make all possible combinations from that to, of course, that. All the way around.
But I suspect the bird. I maybe it's a pusher. But I don't know.
I'm not willing to make any statement about what a bird is. Actually, I don't think that we can say. I can say what happens when I have a pusher or puller at high. When I include inertia, I can write down those equations. But I'm not. But I'm. It's not clear to me that for a bird I can use such a simple. Description.
But we can still ask the following.
Yes.
Take your favorite Navier-Stokes solver.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? And working at high Reynolds number,
mm-hmm.
put in a point force density, a fourth dipole density of that type and that type. Mm-hmm. Will either of those describe reasonably well mm-hmm. the flow field around the bird? I think the answer is I don't know.
Yeah.
Do you know?
No, I don't know. Exactly.
For
yields.
Yields, okay. But they're not using a force dipole picture. It's probably by using
some kind of
a shape cycle.
Shape cycle and force multiples.
And looking at the
and on the force singularity, force no slip on the surface, okay, no penetration, all that stuff.
Okay, but it's
not a simple pusher and puller at all.
Yes, but
what is it? The leading order.
What's the leading order? I mean, it's got to be it's got to be either a monopole or dipole for leading order. There's a monopole.
No, but there's a monopole. Why?
Because
you're not. I mean, the fluid is not good. I mean, you're not looking at a fluid very far away, like. Locally, it's not a.
Are you saying that's a density? You got a density? Have you got something?
Is that something dilating force by itself? Can it be a?
It shouldn't be a.
Stokes
the car. Yeah, I don't. Yeah, so it's. I mean,
it has to be either a pusher or a puller.
Okay, but is it sedimenting? Is it sedimenting or is it
there's
using?
There's gravity.
It's gravity, exactly.
Yeah,
there's gravity, exactly. So gravity could. That gravity is a force.
So
but,
we'll note our lens question and let Tani go on, right? What's the flow field around?
What's the flow field around a bird? Yes. That's a
owl fish.
Yes.
So I think if one look at Turner 2 model, right? That if you, or if one look at this model, then there's a force monopole.
There's no flow fields there.
There's no flow field.
That's a model in which the hydrodynamics is eliminated. They were only an orientation and a density. So you can't actually answer this question.
So
that's already at a higher level. That's already modeling at a much higher
more
level.
Effective.
Yeah.
So that's in fact the reason we started working on flocks in fluids is because the flocking models to date at that stage didn't have the fluid in them.
Okay.
There's been a certain amount of revisionism in recent years to say we can just go back to those models and change the sign of something and get everything. There are some things that are okay with that and some things that are wrong with that. But we should really.
I didn't mean to blow you off.
No.
Okay. So, but I think that's those are valid questions. So we met for the pushers. Now we see that this instability, because of the way in which the flow fields couple to the forces, that this thing wants to bend. And similarly, if we have the. The pullers. That likes to splay. Okay, so this is what I want to focus on today. Let's look at this problem for the case. Let's look at this pushers and pullers when we have this phase with the phase variable. Okay, so if you want, this is sort of now well accepted among people working in the field. If you're working at low Reynolds number, and you are sufficiently coarse-grained enough you can only worry about the large-scale behavior of the flow field, you know, this is the dominant behavior, and this is what you'd expect. And various approaches, simulations, and sort of theory seem to agree on this.
Danny, maybe you should put up two references to our two papers in the corner. Just
okay. So
Leone and Liverpool, and Pure Power and those two. Yeah, just say.
I don't remember the thing, but one of them is
PRL recently.
PRL 2014, and now help me.
F U umlaut R T H A U E R.
A U E R. Okay. Yes, there was a meeting on the same day, but some people find it easier to get them go through PRL than others.
No, actually, I feel annoyed with myself about that because Tani waited for us to submit.
Okay, so we have an earlier paper where we do some of these ideas, which is in PRE in 2012.
Is that the one that you're telling me about?
Yes, that's what I was telling you about about this nonlinear cycle. Okay. So now let's. So I guess this is maybe not a bad place for us to think about what are the questions that I would like to discuss. And so I guess my question one. So is now static active matter phase coherent or incoherent? Mm-hmm. Okay, that's I guess one thing I think we could discuss. Am I really thinking about averaging over all these phases independently of these?
This is static.
I mean this thing here. So I've got pushers and pullers.
Without
any phase variable.
When we treat active matter without resolving the phases, mm-hmm. are we time averaging over all the phases, or phases assuming they're all coherent?
Or incoherent.
We haven't actually.
And I think that this is something that we maybe are coming to some kind of agreement on that, but I think that it's something that maybe is not clear to everybody. And so I guess, so that's the first and obvious question. The second question, can we think about synchronization for dry active matter? And for dry is toner 2 type models.
Depending on all the standard synchronization models, more or less that.
Yes.
I mean, the ones before, people started looking at flagella and cilia and fluids, and those were wet. But before that, people have been, all these Kawamoto kinds of models were.
Yes.
You can think of them as without an explicit.
Exactly. So I think the answer. I think the answer is yes. I think the answer is yes.
Yeah.
But it's different from Kuramoto in the sense that you can couple
it to motion. Exactly. So the point is the coupling is different. That's the difference. The point is that the coupling is different.
Right.
But there is a coupling. I think that's the most important thing. I think what we've discovered is that it's really, as soon as you couple them, it doesn't really matter. The coupling is once you have a nonlinear oscillator, the way you couple them is actually quite robust to the kind of coupling you put in. That's what we found. And then I guess the third question. Is the time scale for vorticity diffusion now that is basically when you do a low Reynolds number descriptions, you often take the Stokes approximation, you assume vorticity has gone everywhere. So when I have a force, I have a velocity field which is generated by the force. Since we have a time scale here, which is this cycle period, do we have to worry about that? And I think probably my.
So you're asking if this time scale is comparable to the phase variable
time scale. Yes. Okay, so I guess those, I think, are three questions. I think I've really run over time. So I want to just say, maybe I'm going to just now not really talk about what we did. You can read the paper and the supplementary material to see what we did. I'm just going to tell you what we found when we did the same thing with the phases. Okay, so what we did was we did this same experiment that you do, looking at these things, but starting from an isotropic phase, from an oriented phase. So we started from a phase where we've got the particles all aligned. But we put in the phase dynamics, we coupled hydrodynamically appropriately, and asked, what do they do? Like the static case, it goes unstable. But actually, what happens is we found that these things were exchanged. For the phase incoherent case. For the phase coherent case, they're the same. So which is why, so therefore,
and
that's why I asked this question. That's the reason why I asked this question.
So you're saying if it's phase incoherent, then this assumption is correct. No, not incorrect.
I'm saying that this is so. This we did for a particular model, which was a model of an oscillating force dipole. Mm-hmm. So we have an oscillating force dipole, where each of the oscillators is one of the oscillators I was telling you about. So it's this nonlinear oscillator which likes to synchronize in phase. So it has this. So it's essentially, I want to let Shriram speak, so I don't want to go into too much detail, but essentially we just looked at that model. So this is a model which has possibility of synchronizing. And when we found, and then you can play with conditions so that it's in certain conditions when you have the coupling strong enough, they want to synchronize. Other conditions, they don't want to synchronize. And then we looked at this instabilities in those two cases. Mm-hmm. And what we found out was when they're in the case where they want to synchronize, it follows through as a static case.
But
if they don't want to synchronize, it didn't.
Okay. Danny, it's totally baffling, right? Because if you make them phase incoherent, mm-hmm. then the flow field around each one of them, if you make them phase incoherent and with frequencies that are high enough that...
No, that's the point. Frequencies are not high enough.
Ah. They phase incoherent, but perversely at frequency. Okay. Fine, you have an escape route. Thank you.
Yes, okay. So that's the point. So once that's why I asked this question.
Yes. Yeah. Okay. Stop panicking.
Yeah. Okay. So the point is then that the so now I'm looking at this creation where the time scale for vorticity diffusion is, I mean, essentially the vortices has diffused. So therefore these particles know about each other, and actually so and then in that case the.
Well, the particles know about each other anyway. Yes. This is where they know about their cycle.
What I'm going to say is the cycles know about each other, mm-hmm. hydrodynamically. The cycles
because
have dynamic coupling.
Because the frequency is low enough.
Yes. Yeah. Yes.
So the time that it takes them to go through a cycle is long compared to the vorticity motion. Is that?
Yes.
Viscous penetration depth at that frequency takes it to the next part.
Yes. So in that case. And what happens? I mean, I only have arm-waving arguments. Is that really the phases now couple? The way in which this kind of state is that now you find now that in the case where they're all identical, there's nothing you can do. You've got to bend them. But now the phases couple, and so you get variations in phase across these modes. And there's competition between the phase variations and the bending and the instability that you find for the actual. And that competition means that in certain cases, and so in certain limited cases, when they're very coherent, you get backward, of course, you know. When they're very incoherent, you get things flipping around.
Incoherent but slow.
Phase incoherent but slow.
It gives you something very different.
Very different.
Okay.
So.
But is there an easy way to see why they reverse?
So I don't think those are the two possible. I mean, I think what you can see is that there are these tendencies there, mm-hmm. and the phase, the coupling of the phase to the hydrodynamics, gives you another way of dissipating. And that, in general, that way of dissipating could help you or hinder you, and it can move you from one of those to that. And I think it could be model dependent. So I think it really could be. I think we could cook up another model in which maybe, you know, where this could not be the case. So I think it's really the fact that this adds another mode of dissipation, and that can help you or hinder you. And so it can essentially. Play with your.
What are your individual oscillators? These are not Golsani instruments.
No, they're not.
I mean, Van der Poel or something.
They're Van der Poel oscillators. So I guess I could write out. So you have
it
to.
Doesn't matter.
Yeah, I mean, it's a Van der Poel oscillator with a caveat. It has this extra thing that it likes to synchronize, which.
So hydrodynamically coupled Van der Poel oscillator.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. So let me just write down the equation. So I have something. So I have 1, 2, and F1 is equal to minus F2 to make right. So I have this, and then I have my equation of motion for particle one. I would have the usual. And now, this is Van der Poel. This is Van der Poel. But then what is new is we put in this term, because we found out, Marco found out really, that actually having this term really makes this object a very robust synchronizer. So if it's positive, it synchronizes in phase. If it's negative, it's synchronized, it's out of phase. So in some sense, it gives you a kind of analogy of a...
So X is the relative coordinate?
X is some internal coordinate of so it's oscillating about some center. So X is the oscillation of one beat around the center.
X1?
Sorry. These are all X1s.
These are all X1s.
Yes. And so the way it... So I've got... This is an oscillator. Mm-hmm. And then the other one, of course, balances.
But how do the different oscillators couple?
And then they couple hydrodynamically. So basically, so then if it's in the fluid, obviously it's a bit complicated because it's a rigid object, and I've got to look at the component that's along the center. So it's a bit more complicated than that. But essentially, just get convected by the fluid, apart from the fact that it has this internal dynamics. That's the model that we've done, and we've chosen it because I said this allows you to control very, very carefully the...
And from this, you can get an effective equation for the psi.
Yeah, exactly, for that. And so that's, so basically this paper is doing that. We are calculating that. And the way we do it, I mean, I'll just say it in words, this thing oscillates, so you can write out the internal degrees of freedom as a kind of in complex form, and then you do the usual coarse graining that you do that you read across in Hohenberg or something like that, where you do this, you look at the slow modes, you integrate out the fast degree of freedom, and you get the effective slow degrees of freedom. So that's what we do. We just do a. And so I would say one thing I think is quite nice about this model is that this is essentially a normal form of a nonlinear oscillator. And as long as mu is bigger than zero, this thing has continuous oscillations. And when mu is very close to zero, the oscillations look very circular. As long as mu gets bigger, they get highly non-linear. And that seems to be important in getting this type of behavior. And this alpha makes things very robust. So alpha positive, it means that it's always synchronized in phase. Alpha negative means they are kind of antagonistic. And other thing I've talked about here is when alpha is positive, they want to synchronize in phase. So I think there's a whole nice, interesting bit of physics to look at what happens when they're out of phase. Mm-hmm. And one more thing is, if you look at this limit cycle in a bit more detail, then what this alpha term tells you is how the frequency depends on the amplitude on the limit cycle. So essentially, I can say X1 undergoes some dynamics, which is this is basically, and this phi is my phase variable, so that's what it is, and you could, if you want, rough to solve. So essentially, if alpha is positive, it means if you increase the amplitude, the frequency goes down. And you increase the amplitude by changing the parameters. Okay, so that's basically, roughly speaking, what alpha does.
And garden variety bent or pole?
But alpha is zero.
I understand.
Yes.
So the frequency is independent?
Yes. Of amplitude. So once you formed your limit cycle, so you can control the amplitude in terms of by
mu.
Yes. Is it by mu? No. Yes, by mu. Sigma. Sorry, sigma.
By
sigma.
Sigma.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah.
Sigma. So sigma sets the amplitude. Mu just determines whether or not you have an oscillation.
Right.
And so mu determines
the. If you change sigma in garden variety vanderpool.
Yes.
The frequency doesn't change.
The frequency to a large. I mean, obviously.
That can't be true.
Yes. I mean, so I'm saying for mu, small enough. We're looking at relatively small mu's. So if mu gets big enough, of course, then things get really messy. So for small enough mu...
So you're close to the point where it's oscillating?
We're close to half bifurcation. And that's the only point where this is a reasonable thing, is when you're close to half bifurcation. Yes, otherwise the dynamics is totally non-universal. It depends on details, and I don't...
So you're close to the bifurcation.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You mentioned this before, and you talked before, and I couldn't understand what you're talking about.
Okay.
Okay, you're only near the bifurcation.
Yes.
And then and of course,
and that, yes. And of course, that, yes. And of course, and of course, the point is that you this picture really is only feasible close to bifurcation. Because if you're far from bifurcation, then this is almost certainly not a realistic model of any oscillator. But if you're close to bifurcation, this is the minimal model of an oscillator. It's just an expansion of my things in a. It's the Landau theory of oscillators. I mean, it's just. You know. I mean,
if you're far from it's a relaxation oscillation, they happen all the time.
Well, no, I mean, I'm saying that I could think. Then, my point I'm making is that I could, I could add in lots of other. Once I get mu gets very large, then adding in more terms here.
It's an expansion in X1.
Yes, I'm saying that this is an expansion in X1. And I'm saying that once mu is very large, this expansion isn't really well controlled, I'd say. Okay, so in that sense, I think it's consistent in the sense that we don't. I don't really think that this is very helpful when mu is very large. For us, anyway. Okay, so that's basically what we found. And I guess then I'm gonna leave Shriram to talk about.
So, you know, this one mic, right? I don't know how many of you have seen the Monty Python sketch, Frenchman talking about this Shriram aeroplane with many decks. They have one mustache between them, they keep exchanging it and talking and then
saying the same thing.
I'm afraid I'm reminded of that.
So the alpha is being added essentially to achieve that.
Yes.
The frequency dependence on the amplitude.
Yes. And the point is that it makes the reason why we included it was it gives us very good synchronizers. So it means that while when alpha is not there, they do synchronize, but much slower, and in a way it depends on detail of while when alpha is there, it's synchronizes, and you can control well enough the in phase out of phase, which is something that we thought was interesting.
Not sure what I should add to what Tani said, but I can.
Maybe you can just describe your approach. I think.
Yeah. So almost everything that we did was basically from a hydrodynamic approach. We had a bunch of calculations, more or less what Tani is talking about of individual oscillators that I think largely don't feature in the paper we finally sent out, because we decided to answer the question of the stability of states with. Okay, let me write something. What can I rub? I guess I can rub this. No. Which side?
Yeah, I think it's
the other side.
It is the other, right?
Okay.
Neither is very good. No, so I actually need my notes or the talk, either one. This is good. All of this is actually very much easier done by showing you the pictures, but.
We can pull down the thing.
I thought the whole idea was just to have a discussion, so let's. Maybe for a couple of minutes, I'll show you three or four slides and then I'll go to the pictures. I'll go to chalk. I think it's better because. I need to connect this here, right? And probably we need to actually switch the projector on, right? Oh, it's right here.
No, there's a.
I think it's not remote. It's proximal. Far from remote. And then it has to find it. Oh, it's finding it. Just a moment. And, will it? Okay, good. It's fine. Sorry, we can turn off some lights here.
And will you get the duster?
I'm sorry? So I want to switch the board lights
off. If you move the eraser, we'll see more of the picture.
Where are the board lights?
Maybe behind that cabinet? No, other side.
Right. Yeah, so fine. This part, I don't need to say too much about. This is just the pushers and pullers picture. These are both, in this picture, pullers, incidentally. But In addition, swimmers typically not only, remember, swimming in the ideal case is force-free, torque-free motion. And so the force densities have to be such that they integrate to zero, the torque densities will be such that they integrate to zero. And so the previous picture I showed you the force densities, by the way, I should say this is a talk written by my dear friend Sebastian Pjotthauer. It's so much nicer written than anything I would do.
Don't worry, we need to make pictures as nice as
that. Yeah, I mean, look. I bet he didn't do them himself. His girlfriend is an artist.
I saw him making that one.
Which one? That?
Yeah, that one.
I think that one.
Okay.
No,
all right.
So,
and now, the point is, therefore, the sort of three basic things in this simple picture that active particles do is force dipoles, here shown as extensile, and a torque dipole, and this, in some sense, is a combination of the two, something that's got both in it. And what we want to ask is, in those two, it's fairly clear there's some periodic motion. In this one also, because there's actually a stroke, there's a time periodic motion. So the question you want to ask is, just as we wrote down more or less from pure thought, the hydrodynamic equations for a collection of actively contractile or extensile force dipoles, can we write down the hydrodynamic equations for a system in which, in addition to these things being oriented, the phase variable also has the potential for a symmetry breaking. And if you do that, what kinds of instabilities do you get? What sorts of states are stable? So what you want to do, therefore, is to write down an equation for the where's the stick?
Is it behind the
talk loudly and carry a big stick. So what we're going to do is this. We're going to describe the orientation of these objects by a vector field or a twister symmetric tensor field, okay, which relaxes in a co-moving co-rotating frame to an equilibrium given by some molecular field plus coupling the fluid. The system will always work for the purposes of this talk in a situation of force balance. We won't worry about inertia, in other words. We'll just say that all forces balance instantaneously. The divergence of the total stress is zero. We will also work at total torque balance, the divergence of the angular momentum current is zero, thank you. The objects out of which we make the stress and the angular momentum current are these types of objects, which represent sort of stereotypic types of motions that these active particles do. So what we want to do is to build, the way one built hydrodynamics for the simpler case where you didn't have to keep track of these periodic motions, we want to keep track of such motions. Now, this is the instabilities that Tani already talked about. I won't talk about this. Let me get past this. Yeah, let me,
Basically, if you're truly hydrodynamic, then you actually don't need the angular momentum flux at all.
No, that's true, but it's very difficult to write down a description for these rotating things without starting with the angular momentum. You're right that
internal spin things, right? Don't you keep track of those if they actually rotate?
No, I'll tell you. Okay, here's a general technical point. Suppose you've got a fluid with objects with orientational degrees of freedom which can rotate. Imagine, you can think of the angular momentum of these objects as two parts. One is a kind of classical spin, that is things rotating about their own center, and the other is orbital. And there's a classical spin-orbit coupling which just says that if something is turning here and it makes contact with its neighbors, it will transmit that angular momentum. Like, you know, if you have a table, if you have objects spinning on it, if they're not touching each other, each one will keep spinning. If they start touching each other, eventually the whole thing will start spinning. So eventually you don't need to keep track separately of a spin and an orbital angular momentum. And total angular momentum conservation is, you know, it can be dealt with by symmetrized stress tensors, etc. We won't worry about that. Right now, I want to return to the point with which Tani began his remarks, which is, until recently, we always assumed that whatever periodic process was giving rise to this fluid flow at the level of a single particle, although it had a phase, we could forget about that phase and just time average over it and get an effective description at long wavelengths where you don't worry about that phase. However, given that this phase is a time periodic object, the potential for breaking time transition symmetry arises. In theories where you averaged over the phase and didn't worry about it, flows were generated only by inhomogeneities in the alignment.
again, it has to be a question of time scale, right?
It is, but you know, the thing is that it's, if you are looking at, it's a question A of time scales and B of
actually breaking that.
No, see, also remember.
If I get global synchronization, then I'm.
But if you get global synchronization, then you are in an in a phase ordered state, and you do have to worry about the broken symmetry mode associated with that. However, it's not only a question of whether the sort of bare interaction between one phase oscillator here, another phase oscillator here through the fluid is strong. It's a question of what it's competing against. Just like if you just calculated an exchange coupling in a magnet, and you found there is a value for the exchange coupling, you can't immediately say, therefore, the system orders. You have to compare it to the noise level, to the temperature. Mm-hmm. In these systems also, in principle, if you want to understand phase transition behavior, independent of hydrodynamics, and if you want to understand ordering behavior of collection of Karamazov oscillators, you have to do a proper phase transition theory of it, which means you have to introduce noise, whether thermal or otherwise, and really study the non-equilibrium phase transition. There is
and
a paper
actually,
by the...
And actually, I should make a comment that in the equation that I didn't get into the details of our description, but we have a noise in our... So in the field that we, the equation I get for phi, which is the phase variable, there's a noise term there, which is coming from these fluctuations.
So you could write it as an effective phase-coupled equation, but with the noise that's generated
by
things that
happen at shorter times. For example, if you do that, you'll end up finding that there is a relaxation for the phase, and a noise, and even in the cost-gradient equations, there'll be a noise, and that can drive a phase transition to a disordered phase. Mm-hmm. We haven't done much of that. Mm-hmm. Something like that has been done in some detail by Tomar Riesler, right? For the basically noisy hop bifurcation.
Yes.
Collection of things, and really analyzed it as a phase transition, and then it turns out that many of the properties are just X, Y, or something, right? But a complete normalization group treatment of that has been done.
But so something that I just remembered, if you think of the standard Kuramoto description, right, where you go from something which is an oscillator and you just go into the phase, then you pick up some noisiness in the
you can have a collection of oscillators with different individual frequencies, but in the phase locked case, they lock their frequencies. The important thing about the usual Karamazov model is each guy interacts with all guys indifferently.
You look at locally coupled one too, but I'm saying in the all coupled Kura model, the reason you get a transition is because you're competing against this
it's a quench distribution.
It's a quench distribution.
But we haven't worried about it. We have not worried.
We looked at oscillators which have an underlying same frequency, but there's some noise in the internal dynamics.
Okay, let me come to the business part of this talk.
Yes.
So let me come to the part of this talk which may be somewhat different from the stuff that Tani talked about. Even though we want to work with hydrodynamic equations, we do build them starting with some kind of description of the level of the individual particles, which is a force dipole and a mixed dipole and a torque dipole, each of which have the following structure. Okay, that is, this is the strength of the force dipole, likewise for the others, and it depends on, you take into account the fact that this the way in which these individual swimmers are driving the fluid is ultimately because of a periodic process. Okay, so the strength of that force dipole is non-zero only because there is an angle variable going round and a periodic variable going round and round. Okay, and you have an object of this sort. You have this form. Rather than just saying this force dipole is proportional to the local orientation tensor, you say it's proportional to the local orientation tensor with a strength that depends on the fact that there is a periodic variable acting locally. If you switch off theta dot, there is no force dipole. Likewise for the others. Okay, the algebra is a mess. I will not describe it. These equations of motion are horrible, but I'll try to say one or two things about them. I don't know if I'll succeed. Am I going to be able? Yeah, I know. It's not very appealing, is it? If I'm glad I wasn't the referee.
Got it much earlier than
I don't know. I mean, I would have.
Rethink questions.
Yeah. normally they show it to those.
But can I just ask you something in the previous?
Yes.
So you're actually saying, you're not just saying that it depends on the fact that it's, but you're saying the S naught is actually a function of the phase?
That's important, right? Because you want a marking. This comes back to the point about there being,
That's really where you put in the fact that.
That's important. Right. Otherwise, they can't synchronize with each other. They can't talk to each other. That physics goes in there.
And of course, that's physically reasonable because what you're saying is that actually the it's doing different things at different points of the cycle.
Right. That's very important. Okay. So you can build hydrodynamic equations whose form is not very enlightening at the moment.
What are theta naught and theta one?
Yeah. So hang on a second. If you go back here, you will see that there are three angle variables. Right. In principle, each of these processes has a periodicity associated with it, a periodic variable associated with it. And 0, 1, and 2 just refer to these three, the force dipole, the mixed dipole, and the torque dipole. And so each of them has an equation of motion which you can build on fairly general principles. I'm not going to describe this to you. Okay.
Actually, on-site assumption is just a statement that some terms are the same. It reduces the
right.
parameter.
That's about all.
It's built from local conservation of free energy. It's a local free energy flux.
Yeah.
Just say that
or pure thought. Okay.
So that's.
And it's these three guys we look at and ask, can they synchronize? And the main thing we do is we coarse grain these to obtain hydrodynamic equations. Okay, from that hideous mess. Let's take the simplest case of this guy that's just pushing outwards. So imagine something which is pushing. Which has a periodic process pushing outward and in, but in such a way, in fact, it could even be an ineffective swimmer. It could actually be a sort of pathetic shaker that doesn't go anywhere. It doesn't matter at the level of a single particle. It still disturbs the fluid. So let theta be the angle variable for that. So you have a stress which depends on the local orientation tensor with this free factor that depends on a time-dependent on the time dependence of the angle variable. The angle variable has a sort of intrinsic time dependence and coupling to the fluid and noise. Okay? And extract angular Fourier components of this guy with respect to the angle theta and build the equations of motion and then ask if they synchronize. So let me.
Basically, I guess, and I want to make a comment that n is 1 corresponds to the. To the phase variable that I found before, and
it's correct. Right, yeah. So n is, you're right. So it's in fact, no, it's gone.
N equals 2 would give you
something like a pneumatic, parameter for the phase.
Right. So I mean, that would be something like where the phase, the orientation distribution function sort of elongates and then straightens out, elongates and straightens out without head-tail asymmetry. So these are the idea basically, and these objects are hydrodynamically coupled by the fact that the orientation, the velocity gradient field couples to the orientation field. And so you just build the hydrodynamic equations, and what you find, this is going to be a mess. Basically, if they're close enough to each other, they can go into. So we find two kinds of instability. By the way, we're supposed to quit at what time?
We're supposed to quit about at 11:30, but I think
we can drag for a few more minutes, right? So in wave vector space along and transverse to the mean alignment direction, you can calculate the real part of the eigenvalue and ask. For the criterion for an instability, and I'm not going to be able to say this in any intuitively appealing way. So let's just say you do find hydrodynamic synchronization. The two results you find is this: one, start with a reference state in which you've got a bunch of swimmers in which the phases are not coherent, and ask if the amplitude of a phase coherent mode, n equals 1, n equals 2, etc., is linearly unstable and starts to growing. Correct. Yeah. So the answer you find is yes, if they're coupled enough, if they're close enough. Answer is yes. That's one part of the story. The second part of the story is imagine you start with a bunch of things that are fully synchronized and in a spatially homogeneous way. So both of these are somewhat extreme states, right? One is you've got a bunch of swimmers, each of them is doing its own periodic process, and those processes are talking to each other in a fluid, but in the reference state, they are
unsynchronized. Introduce a perturbation of, say, as I said, e to the I m theta with, say, n equals 1 or whatever it is, and ask, does that grow? The second is start with a state where these, you know, it's a sort of Busby Berkeley musical level, all these things all doing synchronized swimming. And globally, all swimming together. Is that state stable? That state also, in a large region of parameter space, turns out to be unstable. So what that means is a system, a collection of active swimmers coupled enough to each other, have a tendency to enter a state of phase coherence, but which is neither enter a state of coherence, but not. Yeah, in other words, it's typically like a stadium wave or one of those things. That is, you expect not something where all of them are getting up and sitting down together, but rather where you have things that resemble metachronal waves or Mexican waves or whatever you want to call it going through it. No, so we actually, I'm ashamed to confess, the only thing we have done is at this level of analysis is linear stability trials. In some simpler reduced models, we've actually solved it numerically, and you find many pretty things, which we have not written up yet. We actually, not we, Sebastian. I just watched.
Because in much simpler models, familiar with third-range coupling, and I have no idea what hydrodynamics is doing, but it might be doing something similar. You do get these, instead of having all the things lined up, they're lined up and then they're...
Right, right. Okay, oh, I should say one thing. Most of the analysis we have done has frozen the state of orientation and only looked at the dynamics of the phase variable.
And frozen the state of orientation.
All globally ordered, in a trivially ordered state.
Yeah,
so
I'm
it's okay. Oh, I thought you were talking about the orientation variable as well. Okay. Okay. Yeah. So. Yeah, but this.
Uniform in space.
Right, but that's a wave. So the point, if you like, is that we haven't generated the stable solutions. We have shown that these trivial solutions are unstable with respect to growth. These guys' findings are very, of course. Yeah,
but what we do find is if you look at the modes go unstable, they are propagating modes.
Yeah.
Okay. So that's an example.
Which would point you to that kind of
Have
you not found any stable, inhomogeneous solutions?
No, we haven't looked for stable solutions at all. You know, we've only looked for the linear instability of certain simple reference states. Numerically, Sebastian has looked at reduced models in which you actually find sort of stuff happening, not the equivalent of static cellular solutions like you're thinking about, but maybe we haven't looked enough. So I mean, basically, as a function of the intrinsic oscillator frequency and the typical wave number, you have this is starting from the where do both of these pictures? I forgot. No, I know, but I just forgotten which one is which. Okay. There's something about this which I don't remember. I forget what has changed. We can write down a stability criterion for the synchronized quiescent state. So the homogeneous synchronized state is generically unstable. And just a moment.
So you have my face.
Yeah, and this is the asynchronous state is also generically unstable. Okay, and you know so this is sort of interesting, right? This says that this is even active swimmers whose orientation doesn't change, which is the old way of generating spontaneous flow, can stir the fluid. The internal the coherence, the internal phase variables can set up new kinds of flows. So this is always stable. Presumably you have some kind of phase waves, or presumably you have some kind of wave chaos in some region of parameter space. So the nice thing basically is spontaneously breaking time translation symmetry alone in hydrodynamically coupled objects in bulk fluid. All this analysis has been done actually without even walls present or anything. Can give you spontaneous flows. All the hydrodynamics is instantaneous Stokesian. The issue that Tani raised about vorticity diffusion is an interesting and important one. We've assumed always that what's happening at the level of one oscillator is communicated instantaneously to... No, we've assumed that the time average... And we've assumed that all the hydrodynamics is instantaneous Stokes.
That's what we assume.
No, I know, but now I think it remains to be seen how completely sustainable that is. Imagine if the individual oscillators are slow enough that the next guy,
If they're fast enough,
then the old picture is fine. Yeah.
If they're slow, this tells you what happens when they're slow.
Yeah. No, I'm going back to being worried about whether it's okay.
Is it a steady hydrodynamics or?
Yeah, see, imagine the following. Supposing you have something taking place at this frequency. Yeah. Then you know that fluid, you'll get a velocity field that penetrates out a distance, square root of kinematic viscosity over that frequency. Yeah. The larger that frequency is, the smaller a distance out to which this penetrates. Yeah. So the hydrodynamic effect of a rapid local oscillation can't reach out very far. Right? Yeah, but in that case, so the point is that means that the earlier analysis of the Curie guys, all that, is fine. That's fine. I think the question comes up if you start looking at these oscillators in a situation where they are relatively fast but entering a state of phase coherence. If you want to analyze that, you have to put in unsteady Stokes. Otherwise, you can't analyze that. If they're slow enough that the distance scale, the penetration depth scale corresponding to this frequency is comparable to the distance to some remote neighbors, then you can again go to instantaneous Stokes.
And you can't tell whether all of this would hold, right? Because it could stabilize using
the distance. Exactly. That's the point. That's the thing. You can't tell at that point whether all this holds. I think you have to do the calculation.
Yeah. So I think there is an interesting case for doing unsteady Stokes. So going beyond steady Stokes while still remaining at low Reynolds number. This is a case where it's interesting because always the question of whether steady or unsteady Stokes is to be used has to do with whether the characteristic rate of change is large or small compared to the rate of vorticity diffusion on the length scale of interest. So you can imagine worrying about that. Anyway, so this is what I wanted to say. There's actually a lot more to be done. We frankly have only scratched the surface because we only did linear stability analysis. Sebastian has been studying reduced models numerically, for example, ones in which there are walls present, the momentum at large scales is damped out, so the hydrodynamics is partly screened. So those all become simpler and maybe are more realistic. A lot of the interest in synchronization phenomena have to do with force generators on a solid surface in contact with the fluid, right? Basically clearing your throat or, you know, fluid passing through the lungs or...
this context is a question that came up last time this was discussed. So if you have a cilia, it's actually not... doing just this, right? It's actually not breaking U1 invariance. It's breaking some SO3 invariance.
There's a single periodic process. You can ask, basically, as it goes around this orbit, all points in that orbit aren't equivalent because it does different things. And you need that in order to get synchronization. It's the same point as I was making earlier. The point is, if you just had an object going round and round on a cone, it wouldn't know its way. It's the other degree of freedom that marks
Can you map this whole path on a U1?
No, it's a single periodic process. Okay, you're right. I mean, it's true. The object has more than... Look, life is hard enough.
Yeah,
all I can say is...
Whether the
configuration space that you're talking about is a single variable or not is a separate question.
I can have multiple reactants, for example.
So I think the issue is whether, and I think that there's some problems where you can map it to a single phase variable, and other problems where you cannot. For example, I think that usually that means that there's some nice separation of scales so that you can do all the other ones. I'm only putting that there's only one slow one if that happens in the cycle.
Yeah,
but I can imagine if you have two, for example, I think in the cilia it could very well be the case that if the time you take going up and down is comparable to the time you take going left and right, those are 2 degrees of freedom and they are coupled. But you can write
But it still might be that, you know, some combination of those two matters.
Exactly.
Because there's just one period in it.
It might be the case, but it might be that actually whatever way you combine them, they're always comparable. And that's possible. I think you can't neglect that possibility. But I think, personally, that what Sriram's opinion is rather, it'll almost likely be that some combination of them is the relevant variable.
Yeah. Because you need those two probably for the same reason that Tani's oscillator it takes two to.
So I'm just going back to trying to remember how Kuramoto did
derives the phase model. Right?
Yeah.
It can be an arbitrary vector in some
context. Yeah, 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 right. The point, yeah.
It doesn't matter. Yeah. As long as it's periodic.
Yeah.
And the phase is the slope variable.
Right. The Kornothu is actually, you know.
You start off with n dimensional
correct.
Vector.
Correct.
If
correct.
I have n components
yeah.
in my chemical reactions, if I wanted to look at everything, yes, it's a horribly complicated configuration space. But you get this simplification if there's only one slow variable.
I think all the nice.
And then everything
things.
Comes back, there is
yeah.
a periodicity in the system.
And I would say, even to be more controversial and to be more provocative, I'd say I'm not interested in the cases where it's complicated. I think it's interesting to look at the case where actually
there
is one slow variable. Because that means
so going back,
it's certainly important to resolve any of that before going into the more complicated cases,
but
I would say.
But
and we don't really understand.
This is what I was trying to say, that if you write down the Pore model, there's these frequencies that show up as quench variables.
Mm-hmm.
It can happen even if your oscillators have identical frequencies when you are doing the phase mapping and you have tons of degrees of
and you just
you generate some kind of noise.
Yes, that's
which is quenched in.
How? Why?
So what you're saying is I have all of these variables, right? And I'm going to just coarse grain it so that my phase is the only dynamical variable.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, essentially end up with a
multiple noise, I guess.
Exactly, which shows up in the frequency.
No, but these are noisy in time or noisy from point to point in space? Why is that? So I don't understand it. Uh-huh.
Of the different oscillators become the effective omega.
So this is some. This is like a normal mode analysis. You extract the modes of the problem and you find they are different. Okay. So if you call them enough of them, you can call them some kind of quench disorder. Is what you're saying?
That's what you're basically.
I didn't understand
all
at all.
I'm saying is
yeah,
this,
I'm not understanding.
When we write down Pore model. Saying, you write
that
Pore model, you write it as, you know, phi I dot is some omega I
yes.
plus some coupling, whatever coupling it is,
right.
periodic, right?
Yeah.
So these omega I.
Sorry, yes.
And I have to go back and remind myself of how it's derived, but these omega I's are some omega I naughts of your original oscillators, and those could all be identical, but it's some phase. You're essentially averaging over your cycle of the degrees of freedom sort of that you threw out, and those end up giving you a quench.
Usually you do this sort of this multi-scale analysis. You basically separate two-time analysis, a two-time thing, where you say you have a fast
right.
and a slow, and you have a fast thing.
Now averaging over the, dt over all of the other things that I have thrown out, and that ends up becoming like a quench random. So that's all I'm saying.
I see.
This is not really always just coming from the fact that your oscillator has begun with having random.
And so the effective
but
frequency
the
of the
frequencies when you map to the phase model.
Right. Vary from oscillator to oscillator.
Yeah. But this is right. I presume is a good approximation when you have a lot of oscillators.
Yes.
Yeah, I mean, if you want to call it a noise quench disorder distributed across something, you need a large enough of them that you can just use the distribution and not use a few numbers. Yeah. Okay.
So I think we'll useful. I don't know. I think
useful for me anyway.
Questions. So. Does this hydrodynamic interaction in your model generate alignment of the system?
So, in the calculation that we did, we imposed global alignment of the filaments.
I see.
In the earlier calculations where we didn't keep track of the phase variable, mm-hmm. the hydrodynamic interaction's effect was to destabilize through those cartoons that Tani showed.
Mm-hmm.
However, there are certainly other examples. For example, swimmers in the plane in a layer of fluid. There, the hydrodynamic interaction can promote alignment, not in this class of problems. And there's at least two pieces of work that show this. One is from Denis Bartolo and Olivier Dauchot and company, where they look at rollers in a layer of fluid, and the fluid flow that each roller generates aligns neighboring rollers. The other is from our work, which I'll talk about in a few days, Nitin Sharma, Nitin Kumar, Ajay Sood, and Harsh Soni and myself on granular self-propelling particles moving through a medium of beads. There again, a kind of hydrodynamic interaction produces alignment.
But in the bulk, it seems that's...
In the bulk, this is the dominant effect. Yeah, yeah.
We also did some calculations with Marco, then that's 2010, where we looked at particles in a plane. And we also found that when they're in the plane, you can get hydrodynamic interaction, you can get...
An
ordinary. So. But it's only when you had 3D hydrodynamics and confined the particles to a plane.
Yeah, so you could imagine doing that by localizing them to an interface.
Yes, that would be the problem.
I remember this, yeah.
So, what have that? That's probably in your paper you studied also how does the synchronization promote or
So Marco has recently done calculations, which I'm just reporting what he's done. I understand he found renormalization of that. If you take into account this internal degree of freedom, you do renormalize interactions. But I don't think they added anything new. So the interactions that you have already, the values got changed. So you can't get, it wouldn't generate order if you by themselves. This is still stuff which is
it's gonna just shift the transition.
But this is, I'm only reporting what he's told me.
So if you confine the particles on the interface, so your hydrodynamic kernel will be 1/Q, right?
So, if you confine them in the interface, so it's still 3D hydrodynamics.
No, therefore the interaction in plane becomes 1/Q.
It will be 1/Q and not
Q. There's 3D hydrodynamics.
Exactly, that's right, yes. That's what gives you the strong. That's
3D
why
hydrodynamics in two dimensions is 1/Q.
That's the thing that gives a very strong line. But if you have 2D hydrodynamics in 2D, it's the same.
Or it would have to be 1/Q² then. 2D hydrodynamics
is 2D. Yeah, 1/Q². I'm not saying that, but then it's...
Then you'd have to worry about the part.
Yeah. I'm going to have a log of Q and everything, but since these are diagonals, it's not so bad. But you get similar phenomenology.
Yeah, but if you put in noise, then again, if you put in noise in...
I thought you were assiduously taking notes.
They're supposed to be scribes.
We forgot. One of you is a scribe, right? Oh, brilliant. We hereby post facto volunteer you as a scribe. Thank you. Brilliant. Okay.
Good.
That's great, actually. So thanks, all. That was fun.
I certainly found this. So I think this whole thing about the vorticity diffusion is something that I think we.
Yes, I'm fairly sure it actually matters.
Yeah.
I'm fairly sure there are reasonable situations where it matters. I don't think it's going to be exotic. I think there actually might be.
Okay, so is it lunchtime?
It is lunchtime.
Because you just assumed everything was orientationally ordered anyway.
So no, a major thing is we have not looked at the orientational instability at all.
Yeah.
We promised to do so, and
So I mean, in fact,
we have every good intention of doing so, but you know what they say about good intentions.
You have this quite high dimensional space, because you've got all this. So actually, what we did was we basically here just sort of looked at a reduced. This problem.
Yeah.
We're only looking at one variation of the director.
That's still okay, I think.
The thing. So we basically reduce just a two-dimensional problem.
Mm.
But I think that the general problem would be a three-dimensional problem of all these couple of modes, and you should study them. And we also said in our paper that that's for the future.
I actually think maybe we should now start. Maybe it's the future now, so maybe we should actually start talking about some of this. This is a good start.